Hello and welcome to episode 41 of the Wilder Podcast. In this episode, we discuss what is nature connection, why our relationship to nature is just so broken, and the changes required across all levels of the system. Chloe, hello.
Hello, Tom.
It's a bit of a funky episode, this one. There's a bit of a surprise reveal a little bit later on.
Yes, I wonder how many listeners have already predicted who the special guest might be.
We'll find out. But first, before we go into it, like every episode, we want to give a quick update on who we are, if you're new to the listener, a bit about our project and why we are doing what we're doing, and then we'll jump into the conversation, which is going to be fantastic.
So on that note, Tom, would you like to do the honours?
Yeah, it does get a little bit repetitive. So I am aware that there'll be regular listeners going, come on, guys, we hear this every episode. But I just think it's important that people understand the lens at which we are taking and tackling some of these challenges. So if you are new to the podcast, we are Chloe and Tom, husband and wife. And over the last about year and two and a half years now, ish.
Two.
Almost. Okay. In between the two. 2 years, few months. We have been going on this whirlwind journey, really, from, I wouldn't say no hopers, but I'd say that people probably had very, very little awareness of the crises we are facing, ranging from climate change, biodiversity loss, the rivers, as the previous episode we learned about. And we've gone on this journey where we've decided to educate ourselves, but not only educate ourselves, but also you guys, the listeners, and try and do something about it. So we are the founders of the Grange Project, which is a nature restoration project in Monmouthshire. And it focuses on a number of areas, including obviously restoring nature, helping educate people more, which is again, a key focus of this conversation. Looking to employ and drive more sustainable businesses and also producing as much food from the land as we can in a sustainable way. So there's lots of stuff that's encompassing. I really do recommend going back through some of the previous episodes if you don't want to go through all of them, just to get a flavour of the journey that we have been on. I'm a little bit scared of listening back to some of the first episodes as to how naive we were. We still are, but certainly were at the time.
It's hard, isn't it, is that like shifting baseline syndrome in reverse, where you can't unknow what you now know? And perhaps if we were to listen back, you appreciate just how much we have discovered over the last 2 years. But yeah, absolutely recognising that's a journey that we've been privileged to go on. And yeah, hoping that these episodes continue to help bring people along with us.
Okay, so before we step into this conversation, which I think is going to be really, really interesting, because as we've learned, you know, we were disconnected from nature, unwittingly, unknowingly disconnected from nature. And over the last 2 years and a few months, we've gone through our own reconnecting with nature. So I think this is going to be a great conversation. But we normally give a quick update on actually what we've been up to on the project since the last episode. So I'll start off with, and then Chloe, I know you've got lots to say, but one thing I forgot to mention on the last episode, which is really important, we just had our community day. And what has been beautiful and fascinating and wonderful to witness is the community not only growing as a family, but also starting to take charge. And there are people that come who we know are going to be in charge of certain activities, and they do it so much better than we will ever do anyway. And it's just great because we are just two human beings. We can't do everything, aren't we? And so to know that we are building and fostering this family of extended enthusiasts, experts that come in and go, yeah, Tom, Chloe, don't worry, we can do this.
Absolutely. I think that probably alludes to the fact that we've called it a community day and not a volunteers day, because it's a community day where people do take ownership of different parts of the process. And it's not just down to us to be the leaders as of the volunteers. It's very much a collaborative effort.
I'm only going to name drop one person, because it is so important, but it's Katia. She encompasses everything we'd like to have seen kind of from a volunteer. She absolutely bosses me around, but in a really positive way. It's whenever I suggest trying to do something, especially in the market garden during that community day, she just looked at me and was like, no, Tom, we're not, in her German accent, we're not doing it that way. This is the better way. And she's right 99% of the time. So it's just great to have someone like that that can just, well, make sure we don't do anything wrong, has the confidence to help basically organise things and drive things forward.
Definitely. And I think there's a recognition there of the richness of skills that people come with to our community days, whether you have expertise in soil health or welding or trees, all are really valuable and welcome because we basically don't know nothing.
And yeah, welding was a good point. I'd broken our flail mower, which we used to maintain the path for the permissive trail around the land. And then Alan just says, I'm a welder, Tom, I'll bring my kit round. And he fixed it for me, which is great because I didn't know when I was going to get around to doing that. And now I can use it more freely. Anyway, so that was my point.
So moving on to some of the other updates from the project over the last few weeks. So the first thing I'm excited to say is that we've had our first harvest from the market garden. Most of what we're growing still needs a little bit of time in the ground, but we have harvested some red mustard and Swiss chard, and we've enjoyed them on toast, in casseroles. I've stuck them in all sorts of things, and it's really exciting to see, sort of experiment some of these different flavours and how we're going to use them in dishes to welcome other guests to the project.
Yeah, I do feel like you're experimenting on me. And there's, you know, most of the wonderful, don't worry, listeners and community members, I will be your willing guinea pig on this one. But with the pure main effort is to ensure that we can feed people who come to the project, doesn't matter why, if it's schools, if it's corporate away days, if it's people staying in the cabins, whatever it might be, if we can feed them off the land, that's part of our drive for niche connection. See this whole linking thing?
Very good, Tom. Yeah? And I think there is something special about not just obviously the quality of the produce, knowing it's come from a garden where we've not used any chemicals, where it's been in a polyculture design system, but also that sense of having taken that journey of that thing from a little tiny seed into something that you can actually eat is a really fabulous one. So I'd really encourage anyone that hasn't had the opportunity to even start with some microgreens, because it really does change how you see food. But maybe more on that in a subsequent episode. But the other update I think is really fascinating this year is just the abundance and diversity of wildflowers that we're noticing across the project. And you've spotted two quite special ones over the last week.
Yeah, a purple one and a, what was the other colour?
Yellow.
Yellow. They were beautiful.
So as you can tell, Tom's eye for detail perhaps isn't. And in some ways, that also connects into our conversation on Nature Connection, which we'll come back to later. But effectively, what was really exciting is that Tom identified some yellow rattle. And the reason that is just quite so exciting is because the hours that myself and some community members spent spreading yellow rattle seed in the autumn. The reason why yellow rattle is particularly important for those that might not be aware is because it's called the meadow maker. So it's essentially parasitic to the grass, which is a good thing when you have too much grass, which is what we do have and what most of our British countryside has, which is too much grass. So the yellow rattle is notoriously difficult to, I don't know, grow.
I don't know.
I was trying to think of a fancier...
Germinate, isn't it? I don't know. To propagate.
Appear? I don't know.
Cool. We should learn this. We've said this a number of times. Anyway, keep going.
It's hard to make it grow. And to be fair, we did scatter a lot of seed. And we have, how many have we found?
I'd say one big clump and then a couple of scattered stems. I think lesson learned with this one. Again, as we're going through the journey, we're learning. We scattered it where the pigs had rootled, which made sense because that was bare earth, therefore easier for it to grow. But it being parasitical to grass and the pigs rootling and clearing said grass from the area, I think we may have, you know, for every other kind of seed we might want to spread, if any, it makes sense to do it in the middle of these rootled areas. For something that's parasitical to grass, I think it needs to be where the grass is.
It's an interesting conundrum because it also does, you know, even it says on the packet, it needs to be bare earth, but you're quite right. I don't, yeah, does that mean it doesn't have a fit? If anyone is an expert in yellow rattle, please come back in touch because we don't really know what we're talking about. But anyway, we're very pleased to see it because it's a good indicator and it, you know, we're happy that it has decided to appear in our landscape. And maybe the rest of them will just lie dormant and they're all going to appear next season. We'll see. But the other exciting one is the purple one, also known as the Southern Marsh Orchid.
Purple one.
Now, I know people get very excited about orchids. It feels like we need to get an expert on wildflowers in.
Yeah, because I've got some questions about that. Like that importance, kind of the importance of the role that they play versus kind of more rewilded landscape versus a meadow, hay meadow landscape and that conflicting viewpoints. It'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
I think that'd be a really good discussion. So, yeah. And since our last episode, we've also welcomed our first official guests to our little cabins.
Yet Ryan and Carrie, they were brilliant. I mean, if Colesberg made guests, these two would have been that. They were so enthusiastic. They were here because they specifically wanted to come to the Grange Project and see what we were doing because they were listening to the podcast. And they just had such fun exploring all the areas that we've spoken about. They had great cameras and took some amazing photos of the wildlife, explored the local area, and were just genuinely nice people to have around. And not only that, despite, you know, being paying guests, which of course the project appreciates, they then, a few days later, unbeknownst to us, a gift comes in the post.
And I think this is a hallmark of great guests, that they obviously knew us well enough to know that, you know, probably some flowers or bottle of wine weren't quite going to be our vibe. So they sent us some homemade Nesto pesto, which is like a nettle-based pesto, which is incredibly cool and has been very delicious. So a big shout out to them and a thank you. But I think the other thing just to note is this is all a big experiment for Tom and I. And we weren't exactly sure how it would feel to have people staying in the cabins, on the land, as guests of the project. But if anything, it's enhanced my appreciation of the space here, because they had the time to really invest in exploring the wilder areas in a way that we haven't been able to. And it was just so infectious seeing them coming back and talking about what they discovered and the peace and the energy they felt in the land. And it's just wonderful to see the project through new eyes at times.
Now, the bar has been set. However, no, zero expectation that you send gifts after coming to stay. But please, if you are interested in coming to visit the project, the cabins are ready for guests. Links will be in the show notes, or just go to the Grange Project website and click on the Stay With Us button. And without further ado, let's step into the conversation today, all about nature connection. Dr. Chloe Constable, welcome to the Wilder Podcast.
This is weird.
It makes sense, and I think that's why we're doing it. We've spent a lot of time thinking about nature connection. Well, specifically you have. I've just been messing around on Digger and recently managed to lose its tracks, and it's now stuck in the middle of the field, which is my accomplishment for today. But you have been thinking about this a lot, and it's such a fundamental area to cover for lots of reasons. You're the person to elaborate on this, but so we thought, why not interview you?
No, I am genuinely looking forward to the conversation because, as you say, it has been a subject of consideration over the last year or so. And yeah, I'm excited to share the concept and the insights to the listeners because it's certainly changed and shifted my understanding on and relationship to the natural world. So I'm hoping it might have a similar effect on those that enjoy this podcast.
And me. That's why I'm here. I'm here to learn from you. But, you know, in keeping with tradition, would you mind introducing yourself, your background, and, you know, how you find yourself doing what you do now?
Well, I'm not going to dwell on this because I'm aware that if people are regular listeners, they probably have a sense of who I am. But I am Chloe. I'm a co-founder of the Grange Project alongside with Tom. And that involves a number of different identities, from market gardener to rewilder to volunteer coordinator. But the identity that's probably most relevant to the conversation today is my professional background, which is as a clinical psychologist. So I did 10 years in the NHS, and I guess what led me into clinical psychology was a desire to improve well-being at a societal level. In my time in the NHS, I tried working at all different levels of the system. So working with individuals, working with families, working with teams, working with the very structure of the services that we operate within. Throughout that time, I felt there was a risk, really, that we would start doing more harm than good in how we were operating. And to kind of explain that better, I felt what we were doing was essentially pathologizing what was understandable distress. Many people might be aware that we've been seeing increasing levels of distress at all levels, from young people to adults. And how we make sense of that, I feel, is better understood through some of the systemic factors that are influencing people's well-being. So to do with the cost of living, the pressures of social media, our disconnection from nature, which I'll go on to talk more about, as opposed to this idea that maybe this is all about biochemical imbalances in our brain, which might be a medical understanding of mental distress. And even that individual therapy is going to be the answer to that, or more investment in mental health services, as opposed to thinking more broadly. So kind of in response to that, this is what led us to the Grange Project and rewilding. And I suppose the hypothesis there is that if we're not caring for our planet's well-being, then how can we look after our own? And throughout the last couple of years, I've been really trying to find a way of connecting the work I've done through understanding human distress and within that, the kind of systemic factors and the Grange Project and the rewilding. And it really feels like the concept of nature connection is a way of harmonising those two ideas and ways of thinking and being. And because of that, it's become the focus of my research. So I work at the University of Bath in the psychology department there, and also the focus of the Grange charity. So it's definitely a concept I've been thinking a lot about, and I'm really passionate to share it with you all today.
We're not trying to say that if we all just fix our nature connection, then we're all going to have all singing, all dancing, squeaky clean mental health. I think there are genuine people with genuine challenges, and it's extremely hard. But I think what we're trying to say is there's a lot we could be doing just generally to get our house in order before we start worrying about other stuff.
Yeah, I think you're really right there to say that. Obviously, I'm not saying that we should never consider therapy, or people should never consider medical intervention at times. My passion has always been early intervention. So thinking about a societal level of distress. And that can be about what we're eating, how we're moving our bodies, nature connection, how we're spending our time productively in terms of our workplace and within education. If we get some of those foundations right, I think we all have a much better chance of having robust well-being.
We're at risk of getting me on my high horse already about the, you know, your point about the, you're rolling your eyes. I'm here to support you on this.
I knew you were going to be challenging, which is great. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
I'm not, and you're very defensive, darling. I was going to say support you. And I think my high horse was around our frustration when we talk about this and the importance of having upstream intervention, and my theory that governments don't like upstream intervention because it's very hard to quantify. Often it may, if I'm being skeptical, fall into the other party's time in office. It's actually, why would they make changes that it might not happen? You might not see the benefits for 5 years, and maybe you might not be in office at that point. So hard to quantify and may not benefit you and your political party. I just think that's the bit that maybe, call me a skeptic, but I'm frustrated by that personally.
I suppose that's why I'm really passionate about doing robust research around this concept of nature connection to help evidence the benefits it has for both human and planetary health.
Yeah, see, and we agreed on something. We're only, you know, 5 minutes into this chat. This is going to go really well. Don't worry. Okay, let's take this back to basics. What is nature connection and what is it not?
So this idea of nature connectivity or connection with nature is used quite a lot colloquially in everyday conversation, but there is a kind of academic definition of it that is quite specific and is how we'd be kind of referring to it in this conversation. So I'm going to give you the posh definition first, and then I'll give you my interpretation of it. So Miles Richardson, sorry, Professor Miles Richardson, who is the head of the nature...
Must know what he's talking about.
He's the head of the Nature Connection Research Group at the University of Derby. So absolutely. And he's published some really great books, which I can put links in the show notes to later. But essentially, he would define nature connection as a realization of our shared place in nature, which affects our being. So how we experience the world in the here and now, our emotional response, and the beliefs and attitudes that we hold towards nature. So if I'm going to just sort of deconstruct that a bit, nature connection, it kind of goes beyond this idea of spending time outdoors or accessing nature. It's really about the relationship that we have with nature, specifically within that, the emotional relationship, and therefore how we care about nature. So do we see ourselves as interconnected part of nature? Do we see ourselves as having a role in caring for nature, not just seeing it as something like a backdrop for activity? So how do we quantify that is quite challenging, but essentially that's what we're referring to. We're referring to the sense of the passionate relationship we have with nature when we talk about nature connection.
I definitely like your definition more, but it's still quite an abstract concept. Like you said, how do you measure it? How do I know my levels of nature connectedness on a scale of 1 to 10? Is that how it works?
In some ways, yes. I guess it's like, how do you know you have a relationship with anything? It is a difficult thing to quantify, but the most often used measure in psychology, we love to measure things with a questionnaire. And in nature connection, we have something called the nature connectedness index, which essentially is a load of lists of items, and you have to say how much that item reflects your experience. So if I was going to give you a few examples of the items on the index,
shall I answer it?
Go on, you can say I can't remember what the exact quantifiableness of this is, but that doesn't really matter for the point of the conversation. Essentially, you can just say on a scale of 1 to 5, mm-hmm, how much you agree with each thing.
I really want to 10. I feel like I need a bit more flexibility.
Okay, you're probably messing up all the psychometric profile of this questionnaire, but it doesn't matter. It's just an exercise in demonstrating what this index measures. So I feel part of nature.
I'll be interested to have done it before we start this journey. And I know I feel like 9. I think there's always more things you could be doing and more ways in which you could be part of nature. Or an 8 or 9, I'd say.
I always find beauty in nature.
Again, I would question that question because I think...
I need my questionnaire. I'm just going to put this out there.
I think nature is beautiful, but equally, I think nature, if you strip it back, is quite a brutal place. And I think understanding and appreciating that both beauty and the brutal elements of it would demonstrate your understanding of nature itself.
This could be a very long evening. Right. Being in nature makes me very happy.
Yeah. Why not?
Come on, give me a number.
Unless it's raining, so it's got to say it's about 8.
I take notice of nature wherever I am.
Yeah, I reckon that's a 10 now. I think I'm at a point where I do. That is the beauty / whatever you want to call it for me at the moment, is that it's every time I step out, because we're increasing my nature connectedness, I think is the right phrase, but that, you know, it's an adventure every time we go out because we're looking at everything. We can start to learn the names. We can start to understand why it's happening. So, yeah, I think I'm there, 10.
And the last one, for illustrative purposes, I feel a sense of oneness with the natural world around me.
Ooh, what does that mean?
However you want it to mean. I mean, it's quite similar to the first question, isn't it? I feel part of nature, because often within psychometric questionnaires, you have similar items to check kind of reliability and validity and stuff.
Yeah, I'm not comfortable with that question. I feel you on that.
Psychology researcher's worst nightmare. I'm just going to put this out there.
I feel like we're letting down nature. So I feel like the oneness would suggest you're on the same team. And I don't feel like we are. So I don't know. I'm going to just pass on that question.
Well, essentially, if you'd done this properly, you would end up with a little score at the end. Mm-hmm. And that will suggest how nature connected you are. And that helps researchers then discover whether some of the interventions they're doing helps to increase people's nature connectivity. And also it helps us do things like rank where we are in the UK compared to other countries globally.
Do they have on those questionnaires, sorry to probably flogging a dead horse here, but probably not the best analogy.
No, absolutely not.
But I would like a definition of the question. So it's like describing what at one nature would be in order to allow you to answer that. Because it's an abstract question. Everyone would interpret it differently, and therefore surely it's not accurate.
I skip having to go into a whole psychology lecture about the difference between quantitative and qualitative research and the paradigms of psychometrics. I think it's a very valid question, and that is why much of my research is focused on essentially meaning-making, storytelling, qualitative research, as opposed to quantitative research, which would be much more, let's look at this measure, this number, and that it represents something, and therefore we can be confident in it. It's quite a limited story. I think it has a place, but I think alongside stuff like the Nature Connectedness Index, you also need to privilege stories and the analysis of people's lived experience, which is much more the kind of qualitative research world.
Which we're going to probably talk about a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely where I feel most comfortable in terms of my research experience.
Okay. So despite me poking holes in the idea, utilizing that index, where are we as a country in that global index of nature connectedness?
I'm actually going to put this back to you. So there are 65 countries in the survey looking at nature connectedness. Where do you think Britain might rank on that?
Shall I ruin it? 33.
59.
Wow. Well, I don't know. I thought I already knew that. No. I knew the answer. I don't know where I got that from.
So it's kind of to add to our being one of the most nature-depleted landscapes in the world, we can now add to being one of the most nature-disconnected societies in the world.
Not a surprise, is it? Here's a question for you. I wonder if that matches with the mental health in terms of the correlations between the countries who are most nature-connected and their mental health challenges and vice versa.
I couldn't give you that answer off the top of my head. I do know that if you look at what we alluded to this in our podcast with Tony Juniper, that actually its income inequality is one of the greatest predictors of societal level distress. But I'm sure nature connection is also part of the mix in that. If you look at all the different factors that predict well-being, I would say it's got to be up there with one of the key factors alongside things like inequality.
It's going to have to be literally the premise of what you're trying to do.
Yes, I hope so. But I guess what's interesting about that is that within the British culture, there's lots of kind of, you know, we are a landscape of landscape painters and poets who there's a kind of strong sense of our, you know.
Gotta say, I've not met many of those recently.
I guess I was thinking more in terms of a historic association. And, you know, the British countryside, England's green and pleasant land, there is quite a lot of heritage association with nature. So I find it quite surprising that we are so low. And actually, only 10% of the UK population feel that they are truly part of nature.
I'm surprised it's that high, actually, thinking about it. And you know, clearly, back in the day when we were festooned with landscape painters and poets, I would guess that the majority of the population actually lived in rural areas, or a good chunk of them. Whereas recently, I say recently, Industrial Revolution, we've all gone, I'm not sticking in the back end of nowhere. I'm going to go into the city where all the jobs are. And but then obviously that's moved us away from nature, which in hindsight probably wasn't the best idea.
No, you're absolutely right. Like, I think if you look at, this is hard to test empirically, so like with a research study, but if you think about it theoretically, then urbanisation has been a massive factor. And obviously within the UK, we were the kind of heart of the Industrial Revolution. So that's been a big influence in our relationship with nature. But I think you could perhaps go back even further. So you think about the agricultural revolution. So obviously there was a time when we were hunter-gatherers. Mm-hmm. And within that, we had to kind of be in harmony with nature. We had to take what was sustainable from the landscape. We had to understand nature. Within indigenous communities, there's often a sense of nature being a benevolent parent that would gift us with particular fruits or honey or animals to eat. And it was a very much more of a kind of equitable relationship with nature. But as soon as we moved into agriculture, obviously we became fixed in where we lived. And then we started to try and take control of the natural space around us. So we were domesticating animals, we were growing crops, and then we kind of have a sense that actually the food that we've produced has been through our own efforts and expertise, as opposed to essentially through living in an ecological harmony with nature.
So that concept of that we are mastering nature, as opposed to, well, it's funny because we've gone on that mini journey here. We've moved here and we've gone, nature, come back, let's be at one with nature. And then we've gone, right, let's start growing stuff. And then that reverse journey we've gone on in this like microcosm here, where we've gone, we need to keep nature out. We need less nature in the market garden. So then we had deer fences put up and rabbit fencing underneath the deer fencing, and significant efforts to stop nature from going into those areas. So I don't think there's any blame being pushed onto those agricultural farmers at the time, because that's what they had to do in order to survive and thrive as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We can only make decisions in the context that we're within. And obviously, agricultural revolution led to increase in population, lots of other factors. And I mean, we weren't nomadic, and therefore we were able to build other sorts of communities. And, you know, there are lots of benefits of the agricultural revolution. But I think one of the factors that we could probably all agree with is it has created a bit of a sense of dominance over nature, or perhaps more of an extraction of nature as a kind of resource to feed us, as opposed to something that we live in harmony with. Going back to this industrial revolution, and I suppose within that, we're also now talking about the technical revolution. It's much more about this distance that's been created from nature. So urbanization is one example of that. But also with the rise of things like convenience foods, supermarkets. In fact, we don't even need to move now to order food. We can literally Uber Eats. Well, you can't here. Just
no, clear. Not where we are.
But, you know, in a lot of urban settings, it can just literally arrive being delivered to us. And all of that means that we can live without having to interact at all with any natural systems around us. You can live entirely in a technical box where you don't even have to leave your house.
Yeah. When you lay it out like that, it is terrifying. But no one steps back and looks at it from 50,000 feet and goes, right, what's happening here? Everyone's too busy in the trenches dealing with their day-to-day challenges. And no one goes, right, well, do you know what's actually happening here to our population, to these humans that all used to be hunter-gatherers, or used to be at one with nature, even with agriculture? And now nobody, including us, can name it, let alone, you know, interact with it or connect with it. And by the way, for those listeners wondering how this conversation is going, you're getting a window into the kind of conversations Chloe and I have when the kids aren't hanging off us or demanding our time. So it is normally this fast-paced, and it is normally quite, you know, rapid-fire information. So I hope you're appreciating the window into life at the Grange Project.
And I think going back to the point you were making about zooming out and making sense of things, I think that's why a lot of us are returning to think about Indigenous culture and communities and wisdom in terms of how do we apply some of that understanding.
I'd just challenge that first. A lot of us is an interesting statement.
A small percentage of the environmental bubble is returning to Indigenous wisdom to help us try and work our way out of this pickle we've got ourselves into. Because, you know, never mind, well, alongside the loss of nature connection, we are also one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world here in the UK. I mean, just a figure to remind us. So 2/3 of the global animal population has been lost in the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. So that is absolutely mental. And that essentially reflects our broken relationship with nature, arguably reflects that, because we obviously don't see it in any value or worth, the fact that we've allowed it to decline so significantly.
And that stat, firstly, utterly shocking. But if you asked the population now of the UK, has the population of wildlife in this country gone up or down in the last 50 years? And if it has, by what percentage? You know, how many people could actually accurately even get within 10, 20% of that?
It's a really interesting question. I don't know. But I think what I do see that being reflective of is this sense that we've got with nature, that we feel like we're in this extractive technical relationship with it, where we just harvest it for its services that it provides us, as opposed to necessarily thinking about the relationship that we have with it. And that true relationships are not about domination, but they're about reciprocity and understanding and care and compassion, and how I feel we have really lost that with nature.
This may be going to the weeds a little bit, and maybe too early. And if it's too early a question, we can talk about it later on. But so everything you've said makes sense to me, and obviously is clearly what we're trying to achieve here with the Grange Project. But what about these cities? What about people that live in the city? How do the people there, how can governments or local councils address this when they don't have access to this in the middle of the beautiful Welsh countryside?
I think it's an incredibly important point. And actually, that practical barrier of access to nature, it's hard to feel connected to it when you don't have anywhere to spend time with it. And I'm going to give you a little fact. So 35% of UK households don't have any green space within a 15-minute walk.
Wow.
And perhaps predictably, low income and ethnically diverse communities are much more likely to be in that statistic. And I guess even when you do have green spaces around, like in urban areas, often people see them as unsafe. They're often poor quality. They're just a kind of dead grass patch. They're often quite uninviting. And that leads to unequal opportunities to engage with nature. Because, yeah, we are in a much better place here. We're probably in one of the best places in the UK to have a meaningful relationship with nature. If we were living in a suburb of a large city where our nearest green park was half an hour walk away, and when we got there, it was just essentially dead grass and a few sad trees.
Messing around the corner.
Well, yeah, that would really affect our relationship with nature, wouldn't it? So that's one of the, in terms of current factors that influence our relationship with nature, that's a really critical one.
Right. Didn't answer my question there, did you?
What about what government to do?
Yeah.
Let's come back to that. Okay, let's talk about the current situation and then we can come towards some of the policy changes that might be needed to address it. But can I just give two more other factors that I think are currently affecting our relationship with nature?
Yes, please.
So first of all, we talked a bit about the technological revolution, but, you know, how are we spending our majority of the time at the moment when we are most people at this, what are we doing 8 hours a day?
On our phones, probably.
Exactly. So when we wear our phones, we're not connected with nature, are we? Yeah. Because we're looking at a screen. And actually, we also know that, well, higher smartphone use is associated with weaker nature connection, which, you know, we didn't need a psychologist to tell you that. It's not saying that all technology is a bad thing for nature connection, but certainly social media and spending a lot of time on Instagram reels probably isn't great. And also because it just means that digital immersion means that we don't have those opportunities to connect with even the small parts of nature around us, whether that's a dandelion growing through a crack in a pavement or an oak tree in front of us.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm definitely guilty of that in lots of ways. When you've got 10 minutes to spare and you've got a gap of that 10 minutes, it's very easy just to get out your phone, sit on YouTube Shorts or whatever, and in a blink of an eye, you don't even know the time has gone. But you've just filled up that time, you've been entertained, inverted commas, and then you move on to the next thing in your diary. But if you didn't have your phone with you, what would you do? Probably I would go outside, although I do try and do this, but I'd probably go and sit outside. And we've got some house martins that are nesting in the eaves of the house for the first time ever. And I get to watch them have marital disagreements and bring all the food back to the nest and chirp away and fight and dive and bomb. And it is magical. I'll accept that. But it's just convenient sometimes to have the phone out, which I hate saying. And I would, if we weren't trying to have some positive influence and influence beyond our 80 acres with our project, I would 100% want to get off social media and just stop using my phone.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the other challenge really is you've got some of the brightest minds in the world working for these big tech companies, trying to make all these platforms as engaging as possible, using every psychological technique they can think of. And nature's trying to compete with that. It's really difficult.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, that brings me back to my other soapbox I could get on about the importance of, why are those people doing that? Would the brightest minds in the world rather be doing that? Or would they rather be doing something positive for nature? Well, they would probably rather be doing something positive for nature. But guess what? Doing the right thing and doing something positive for nature doesn't pay. And understandably, people want to pay and want to get their bills paid. So, you know, my other soapbox is all about making sure that people doing the right thing, doing the right thing for nature and the planet, should be being paid well. But that's another conversation for another day.
That is. I'm going to go on to my last factor around what I think is currently influencing our relationship with nature. Before we move on to talk a bit about what some of the benefits of nature connection are. Finally,
hang on a minute. Who's doing the interviewing? This is not the way this works, Chloe. I ask you the questions. You don't tell me how this works.
Do you want to ask me a question?
Okay, what question do you want me to ask?
So let's just this question. So arguably, particularly since the sort of 1980s and 90s, there's been an increase in this construct of individualism, which essentially suggests that we're thinking about ourselves more and we're thinking about other people and within that, by extension, nature less. So if you look at it in kind of a cultural lens and you analyse the language used in books, songs and films over that period, prior to that 1980s, 90s, there was a lot of like nature-related words in those texts. Since the 1990s, there's been a fourfold increase in the use of the word me in English-related texts. And that perhaps kind of reflects some of that individualism. And essentially that further alienates us from this collective ecological thinking of care for people beyond our immediate sphere of me.
That's really interesting. That's an interesting theory, isn't it? I'd love to be able to go back in time and try and, you know, meet those people, understand the way that they see the world. But as a theory, I think that's really interesting.
And one associated interesting statistic is that lower levels of nature connection have been strongly associated with higher levels of income. you could argue that's related to the kind of increased consumption habits,
yeah,
and a greater kind of preoccupation with the self.
Well, you've got to do something with all that money, and it's really inconvenient if you've got all the money and then you start looking into nature and climate change, biodiversity loss, pollution, plastics, rivers, etc. It becomes really hard to spend the money because it turns out anything you buy, especially if it's expensive, is very resource heavy. So I would suggest anybody who has that problem, who can listen to the podcast, to get in touch, because I can suggest lots of ways in which you can spend all your money on amazing land to help protect nature and do the right thing by the future generations and moving forward. But that's just me putting that out there for people. hello@grangeproject.co.uk.
Well, I mean, and we can go on to talk about some of the benefits of that for your own well-being alongside the benefits for nature.
Okay, well, should we talk about that now then?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably we all know that being in nature is good for our well-being. There's kind of lots of different research studies that looks at cool things like if you touch a tree versus touching plastic, it actually does things to you physiologically. It calms your nervous system. And even just like very brief encounters can have a real impact on our heart rate and our blood pressure and our immune function, all sorts of things. So it's unequivocally understood that being in nature is good for us.
What is the definition of being in nature?
Well, actually, I was about to my next point before you just interrupted me.
Go on, please.
You can get better well-being by being in green spaces that are more diverse and has more visible wildlife and a greater range of habitats. Mm-hmm. So being in nature just means being outside where there are things growing. So, mm-hmm. you know, that could be a football field of one type of green grass. But you get better improvements if you're in a truly natural and wild habitat.
So we've been brought up to believe that these billiard table kind of grass moans within an inch of their life, areas and country estates with like perfectly rigid hedges, that's nature and that's beautiful. But actually, if we're talking about what our bodies and our brains are craving, it's the opposite, really. It's messiness, it's diversity. That isn't a metaphor for life. I don't know what is.
I think there is also a risk that if we start to go on too much about the benefits of being in nature, that we start to perpetuate this idea of nature being a resource for our well-being. And we have to be a bit careful of that because it still creates this disconnection still that we're just extracting the benefits for us as people. We've got to think a bit about that, again, reciprocity and the relationship we're having with nature as opposed to seeing it as something that we just benefit from.
Yes and no. The reality is we're in a society where that is the main effort. If it is me, then there is no point talking to them, that generation, about anything other than me, because it won't get through to them. I think I would take the next step. Then you have to start looking upstream, like, you know, obviously you talk about a lot, and going, right, well, how do we start educating the next generation coming through to be less me and more we, the planet, etc. You're welcome.
I can hear you sound biting right now. But I think maybe what I would say is it feels like we know we're all more distressed. Our mental health is worse than it's ever been, yet we have more resource than we ever have had. So there's something wrong, isn't there? And I just feel like as humans, we do have on some level, and you can see it through some of these studies that show how our physiology changes around nature. We have this innate desire to be connected to the natural world. And I think our modern living conditions have just divorced us from that opportunity in a way that it kind of almost suggests this existential or psychological rupture in our relationship with nature. And I do think that perhaps that narrative of nature is good for us might be a starting point to helping that heal.
Yes.
But it shouldn't be the end point.
No, we agree. Right. So that's the benefits of spending time in nature. Now, am I right in thinking that nature connectiveness, is that the right word?
Yep.
Is different to spending time in nature?
Absolutely. And that's a really astute question because I think a lot of people get these two things conflated. So you can get benefits from spending time in nature whilst being completely unaware of the natural world around you.
So would that be someone going for a dog walk with the headphones in and just walking around the local woods?
Exactly. Thinking about what's going to happen the next day. Yeah. You know, they could be walking in a beautiful biodiverse habitat, or they could be walking on a concrete path with some dandelions and it wouldn't make any difference.
Well, at least there is benefit to that because clearly that's what a lot of people do. I used to do that.
Exactly. I mean, I was exactly the same. I wasn't connected to nature. I liked being in nature, mm-hmm. probably because of some of those benefits that I meant of explicitly being aware of, but were there. But what we're really trying to promote with nature connectedness is an upgrade of that relationship with nature mm-hmm. beyond just spending time in it. Mm-hmm. And there's some good evidence to say that that's great for our well-being, both for our human well-being and also planetary well-being.
Go on then, tell me about the difference.
So the research on nature connection is still relatively young, but they have got to the point recently of looking at kind of meta-analyses, which essentially where they bring together loads of different studies that all look at the concept of nature connection and look to explain particular trends. So in a recent meta-analysis that looked at 16,000 participants, they found that individuals with higher levels of nature connection were significantly more likely to be flourishing. How do they define flourishing? So they looked at two dimensions of well-being. One they call hedonic well-being, which essentially is like, I feel good. I've got positive emotions. I feel satisfied with life. And then the other, which is eudaimonic well-being, which is this deeper sense of meaning, purpose, personal growth, feeling that your life was worthwhile and you're living in alignment with your values. So what we can show is that nature connection increases both of those. The point you raised earlier about the difference between time in nature and nature connectedness, they've studied 5,000 adults within England and they found a strong positive association between nature connectionness and a sense of life meaning. And that held even when you controlled for the amount of time people spent in nature. So you control for that variable. So you're only looking at nature connection, not time in nature. And it suggests that that deep psychological bond you have with nature contributes mostly to eudaimonic well-being, which is that kind of meaning and purpose.
Okay, so here's another question. You're going to love this one. What comes first, chicken or the egg?
So these studies are mostly correlational, not causation. What that means in English is essentially you're looking at associations between things. So it's, you can't really say what comes first.
So to be specific, the nature connectedness or the people who have got a really good sense of direction, grounding, purpose, no one knows yet is what you're, or at least you're aware of, which one we need to focus on first?
No, because to start with, you have to look at whether there are a relationship between variables and then you try and explain how those relationships have come about. That's kind of the next iteration of the research process. Like, and everything, it's not black and white, is it? It's going to be interrelationships between these factors. And, you know, my hypothesis would be it's something around you start to know just nature a bit more, you start to feel a bit better, you start to maybe then take some action to care for nature, which I'm going to go on to talk about. And perhaps if my interview lets me,
I might ask a question about that later. Yeah.
And then you start to feel a bit more meaning and then you notice nature more and then you kind of get into this kind of virtuous cycle of increasing connectivity and increasing purpose and meaning.
We should say at the end, but I really would love to hear the listeners' feedback or thoughts on anything we're discussing. It's hello@grangeproject.co.uk. If you're coming through this halfway through this chat now and you want to contribute to this conversation, we really welcome any thoughts or feedback on this.
Absolutely. Just because something's been researched does not mean it's a fact. These are all just stories that have been told.
I'm, as you know, always slightly skeptical of research studies. I have spent a little time around academia recently and understanding some of the flawed elements of it. There's some amazing research out there. There's some not so amazing research out there. And I think that it's about understanding the research, applying common sense and your own brain power to work out what works for you and what doesn't. So, Chloe, does the research talk about whether or not having nature connectedness helps promote pro-environmental behaviour?
That's a very good question, Tom. And I can cite another meta-analysis that looked at 27,000 participants this time, and they really showed a strong association between nature connection and pro-environmental behaviour. And it's not really a surprise, is it? When you feel like you're at one with nature, that you're part of it, that you feel happy in it, that you care about it, that you're more likely to take actions to support it. And unsurprisingly, there's a specific relationship with what we call pro-nature conservation behaviours, looking after habitats, biodiversity support, looking at sustainable land use, all of that is strongly associated with nature connection. And one of the findings of one of an interesting study is that if you look at young people and you look at environmental stewardship, which is essentially the same thing, pro-environmental behaviour, and you look at education and knowledge and you look at nature connection and what explains environmental stewardship, so 69% of environmental stewardship could be explained through nature connection and only 2% through educational knowledge.
So this is an example, I think, for me, where my common sense and my logic alarm bell starts going off, because I don't think you can truly start to feel connected with nature until you start to learn more about it and you learn more. So it depends on the definition of education. And I'm sure we'd have time to go into that and what they defined as that element. But I don't think there's any way you could just walk through a wood if you didn't know what was happening at wood, you know, at least one or two of the names of the things you walked past, the animals you were expecting to see, just having some foundational understanding of nature and the knowledge of it that's required. I don't see how someone can be connected with it.
I don't disagree with you. And actually, you could say that the fact that we don't really understand our natural world, which majority of us don't, is a symptom of our disconnection. So we can't really separate the two. And if we don't feel close to nature, then we're not going to be curious about it. And we're not going to care about what the bird is called or what the tree is called. So it's like, again, it's a bit like a chicken or an egg again, isn't it? Do you start with teaching people something so that they care more about it? Or do you get them to try and feel emotional about the thing and then they want to learn more about it?
Well, okay, let's talk about our journey. So our journey was having a child, so I'd call it an emotional journey. Then researching climate change. Obviously, the journey was quite factual, but ultimately it was down to the emotional element of, for us, our child is going to inherit this earth. Therefore, we probably should do something about it. And then obviously through that, we've now gone through the biodiversity journeys and everything, all the other polycrises that we've come across. So, all right, I could get behind. It's both and, I think you could probably clearly argue, but and I think you also argue maybe that it's different types of brains. It will be, on one side, it will be the education bit that gets them interested. And then another type of brain, maybe the more emotional, will be the emotional one, which then moves across to the educational side.
Yeah, absolutely. And the challenge...
I should have a PhD in this.
I mean, the challenge of research is obviously looking at trends, not individual experience, which is why we have to be thoughtful about any conclusion. But I think it's a well-known phenomenon across kind of all behavioural change science that just giving people facts and figures doesn't really change their behaviour.
No, that's not education. Again, it depends on how you define it. So maybe we should move on, because otherwise I think we'll go down a massive rabbit hole here. So, okay, there's someone listening to this and they've maybe themselves or family members or their community feel like they may not be as engaged in nature as they possibly could be. So can you give us the Chloe's top tips for getting connected to nature?
Well, I mean, I can give you some of the researchers' top tips as well as my personal experience. I think maybe it's to start with, most people have assumptions that the ways to increase nature connection is through, first of all, spending more time in nature. And obviously that does help, because you... and your nature more, you're going to have more opportunities to notice it. Or they say it's through education and knowledge sharing.
Let's not go there again.
But what we know from research is those things in isolation don't necessarily increase nature connection. You've got to sprinkle some other stuff on top of those things to make them really rich as an experience. So there are five pathways that have been identified as routes to nature connection.
Okay.
The first one is around senses, engaging with the sight, the sound, the touch, the feel, the smell. So that could be going out and intentionally listening to birdsong, or smelling the wildflowers, or feeling the bark of the tree. So really using our senses to deliberately and intentionally engage with nature.
Okay, then what? So I go and stroke a tree, a lick a tree. I go and hug a tree, go and hug our big oak. But without context, that clearly isn't going to do too much, is it?
Well, research would actually suggest otherwise. It would suggest that being present in nature then perhaps opens up other opportunities, because then does your mind is connected in the present with that natural resource. And then what does that lead to? Then if you look at the next four pathways, so you have emotion. So you're trying to elicit sense of joy, calm, love for nature, and sharing those feelings with others. So it could be that rather than going out and let's go bird watching, let's just go out and try and experience joy in watching birds. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you're not going out to spout the Latin of every bird you see, which, again, I have so much respect for people to do that. And they, clearly the people we've had here that can do that have clear joy in what they do, but it might not be for everybody. But actually the ability, like I was talking about the house martins and the ability, I have no idea what they're doing. All I know is that they're having a bit of disagreement, and then you see them chase each other around, and then eventually they make it up and they go back into the nest. So, okay, I can get that.
And that can be also the feeling of awe. So, you know, when you're like, you don't necessarily need to understand what's happening with the weather to feel in awe of it. So that's kind of another pathway. So there's one around beauty. So noticing and appreciating the beauty around us. And that can be through art and music as kind of roots to that. And there's another really critical one around meaning, which is quite complex. It's taken me a while to understand this, but essentially it's around seeing nature's symbolism and rhythms and cycles as sources of meaning. So you can translate that into how you live your life. So that could be sort of slowing down in the winter and recognizing that you might have more energy in the summer because that reflects a natural cycle. Using natural events like the summer solstice or the winter solstice for community rituals, so bringing meaning into your everyday life, or making sense of transitions in our own life using the kind of metaphor of nature. So, you know, birth, growth, decay, renewal. So trying to, again, make connections of meaning between our experience and the cycles of nature.
Yeah, that would be my probably go-to one personally, but I know there are plenty of people out of the community that would really appreciate that and see value in it. And I definitely do, but I wouldn't probably lean heavily into that one.
And this is why there's five different pathways, because different things all work for different people. And then there's also compassion. So caring for nature and then taking action to protect and support it is unsurprisingly a pathway to nature connection. and also a product of it. So it's a reciprocal thing.
Awesome. Okay. So there are all the ways to become more niche connected. Is there somewhere you can like direct people if they want to learn more about this? Is there somewhere you direct them to go? We put links in the show notes.
I wish I could say there was a really accessible resource you could go to. Miles Richardson's books are great. He's written one book, which is quite academically focused, and another one, which is called The Blackbird Song, which is about a practical guide to nature connection throughout the year. So both of those are really great resources. But there isn't much out there. There's the University of Derby Research Group. They have a page. I'll put links to all of this in the show notes. But I'm going to just mention one thing that is a kind of really simple technique that people can try over the next week and maybe give us some feedback, which is this concept of noticing three good things in nature. So this is a really simple way.
Define good, Chloe.
Whatever feels good for you. You essentially want to reflect, it's based on positive psychology, but you want to reflect on three positive aspects of nature that you experience each day. The reason this is quite exciting as an intervention is because it's so simple, and you also don't need a rewilding project to notice three good things in nature. You can notice, as I mentioned earlier, the dandelion going through the crack of the pavement. You can notice the colour of the leaves in the trees. You can notice the feeling of the wind on your face. Research says that it can lead to a 25% increase in nature connection, which in turn can contribute to kind of significant and sustained improvements in mental health.
Okay. Well, I think we should go for that one. Time is flying. Knowing you, I know we've got a lot more to discuss, but I think we're getting towards the end of this conversation today. And we are going to do a wrap up. Although it's going to be interesting how we actually do it, but don't worry, I've got a plan for that. But one of the things that I wanted to make sure we do talk about is that I'm aware from conversations before this recording is one of our focuses and one of your focuses is going to be about engaging specifically adolescents. So can you just talk a bit about why you really want to focus on that and what's the current state of adolescents' nature connectiveness?
Yeah, it's a really interesting statistic. Essentially, if you look at trends in nature connection across someone's lifespan, that on average, when young people reach about 11, their nature connection starts to drop. It hits about its lowest point of around 15, 16. And then it doesn't really recover again until people hit their 30s. So essentially, it's a phenomenon known as the adolescent dip. And it's a universal phenomenon across cultures, across the globe. We see young people becoming increasingly disconnected from nature. And what concerns me about that is adolescence and young adulthood is obviously a time where you make a lot of decisions about how you're going to live, the things that are important to you, your career choices. And if you're making that at a point of disconnection from nature, that's obviously going to inform some of those choices. So I'm really interested in how do we, first of all, understand that dip in nature connection? And then critically, how do we either help young people maintain that connection or reconnect them at that stage of adolescence?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, what does the research currently say?
Nothing. As far as I'm aware, there's no research that specifically looked at why there is this thing of the adolescent dip and how do we maintain young people's connection. In fact, most of the research, interestingly, focuses on under 11s.
And I think it's easiest.
Well, you could have a hypothesis that it is easier to get young people under 11 interested and engaged with nature. And there's also more space for that in the curriculum than you will get in secondary. So I think there are other variables. But yeah, it's something that has been really underexplored in the research that I'm currently aware of.
And so this kind of brings us, circles us back around to the Grey Charity and how we hope to start filling some of those research gaps.
Yeah, thank you for that introduction to the Grange Charity, which is really the passion project and the heart of the Grange project alongside the nature restoration efforts. But essentially what we've done is set up this charity that is specifically hoping to address this question of how we understand nature connection in adolescence and what are the routes or pathways to help reconnect young people. We're at a really exciting stage. We've just appointed our 4 trustees and we have our first strategy day booked in for the end of the summer. And yeah, watch the space. We have some really grand plans around how we're both going to deliver some amazing immersive nature connection experiences here from the project, but also how we're going to use that understanding to help influence policy level through some of the research findings.
I just can't wait to get out into some bushcraft.
It's a really good point there, because at no point in this podcast have we talked about bushcraft. Have we been talking about noticing things in nature and being taking into account beauty and compassion and all those pathways. But I think there is something about what are the unique requirements of adolescence. And I think there are some around risk taking. I think there are some around being connected with peers, around being able to express yourself, creativity. I think digital pathways are going to be part of it. So I think there's something about how we need to find fits for this particular stage of young people's lives that reflects their lived experience rather than getting them to necessarily sit and meditate at a tree, which is a lot of the common nature connection interventions are based around those sorts of things. But I don't know that. These are just theories that I would like to explore alongside young people.
Well, Thank you very much, Chloe, for your knowledge, your passion, giving us your time.
Yeah.
And yeah, watch this space. I just can't wait to see where this goes.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
So, Chloe, what did you think of the guest?
I can't review myself. I don't know. It was all right. Talk too fast, as always.
It was passion. It was good.
I know.
Obviously, that's not. It's a long podcast, this one, so I really don't want to drag this on. But is there anything that you wish you'd said during that chat that you want to just touch upon now?
I think the only thing is that quite a lot of the emphasis in the conversation was around things individuals can do to increase nature connection. I just really wanted to note around the systemic context and the things that need to occur at a policy level to increase nature connection. So little things like obvious access to green spaces, how we help distribute land ownership so people feel more connected to land that they are stewards of. How do we help nature recover? So things like nature recovery networks. So we can increase the quality and availability and people's kind of innate connection to the nature that's physically around them. And also just things like within the education system, where do we make space for not just learning about nature, but forming a relationship with it? And critically, at secondary school age. So that's why things like the Natural History GCSE are really exciting.
DV
is a great example. The Scout movement, all those things have got real great opportunities to help increase nature connection. And also within kind of health and social care, there is an expansion of things like green prescribing and using nature as a resource alongside us. So when you go to the GP because you're feeling really rubbish, rather than being given an antidepressant, maybe you'll get a referral to a local walk and talk group where you can also increase your nature connection. And finally, I think there's something about we need to shift our use of language around nature. So rather than talking about we need to learn more about nature, we need to be really thinking about that connection and seeing it as that we are part of nature, not separate from it.
Awesome.
Maybe can I ask you a question in the tail?
Go on then.
So what are your main reflections from listening to the conversation?
I think that, and you know, I'm naturally quite a pessimistic person. So I think what everything you said makes sense to me. And, you know, we discussed a few things, but it all makes sense. But like you said, it's policy that needs to change if we really want to have a real big impact and change. And I just think that's the thing that does get me down, because I think there's the people that listen to this podcast are people that are already on that journey to some extent. And it's wonderful that people are with us. And we've had our first guest who's listened to the podcast who just literally came and walked the permissive path today. And it was, and he sent us some pictures of him and his family enjoying it on Father's Day. And it's like, this is why we're doing this. This is wonderful. But if we want to create that wider change and that wider impact, it's got to be policy level. And that's why I think the research that hopefully we're going to be doing is going to be so impactful, because we're not going to just think about how do we help the people who are already probably on the journey. It's actually, no, how do we create national change utilizing the research that we do? And we're really going to be starting to put, and you know, once we get the research to back up our perspectives, and maybe some of our ideas are flawed or theories are thought, but once we build that knowledge base up, that research to back up our theories, that's when we're going to start really strategically attacking this to create the change that we so desperately need.
Absolutely. And I think there are lots of routes to that systemic change. Not, you know, I think policy is one of them, but I think telling stories in lots of creative ways, not just limited to an academic paper, is also going to be part of that. But yeah, I'm excited to get started on the journey.
Great. Well, if you've enjoyed the podcast, I think it's probably quite a long one, but I think I've enjoyed it. So I think, and that tends to be quite a good litmus test in terms of whether or not we had a good chat. Please, if you've got any feedback, you want to continue the conversation, please feel free to email us on hello@grangeproject.co.uk. If you have any topics you think we should cover in the future or guests you want us to get on, then we really do value any emails you want to send across as well. And if you want to do something for us at The Grange Project, the thing I always ask on the podcast is, if you've got 5 minutes, just stop what you're doing, rating, reviewing, going on the podcast app or wherever you listen to your podcast, finding The Wilder Podcast and just giving it a star review and writing a few words. It really allows us to build the awareness of what we are doing here on The Grange Project for nature connectedness and also for nature restoration. You know, if you found it useful, other people might too. Right, should we wrap up, Chloe?
Let's do that.
To next episode.
See you then.